Friday postgame show. Okay, Bart, we're going to just, I have to know, what are you playing there? I'm sorry. That's why you played it, because you knew that someone was going to ask.
Okay. It's from that lame music service we go with.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's called Gino Banana. And actually, surprisingly, there's some pretty
Well, it's not surprising.
Music.
We get a lot of customer service inquiries asking JR where he gets this awesome music from.
Yeah,
and it's not. It's just a service of rights.
Yeah. APM Music,
yeah, APM Music,
I do believe, is the name of the service. And that piece of music reminds me of the Muppets.
Okay.
Phenomena.
Well, it had a nice clanky sound to it. It's 128, which is going to come in very important in about 20 minutes. I don't know how that's going to play in, but we got to take note of that. This is a Friday postgame show. I'm here all by myself. No Malcolm, no Steve, no homemade delicious healthy cake, no gin from London. Just water and a TYT official mug.
I'm here, Dave.
It's the first time I ever got to use one of these.
Dave, I'm here for you, dude.
And I have a lot of things to talk about. So your doubters, be ready. We do these Friday postgame shows because the main crew likes to get out on Friday, understandably. It's a pretty rough schedule that they do Monday or all week long. And so they like to cut out early on Friday, but the members do deserve some content on the Friday postgame show. So we give them this. Usually Steve and Malcolm join me. Today I'm doing it alone. I'm going to start with a couple of comments. So Malcolm and Steve, I noticed, are deep into the comments on the postgame show on the website. They're all about responding and communicating. And that's great because for years, probably a decade, Steve didn't really care at all about that stuff. But now I'm glad to see that he's really into it, engaging with the members online. So one of the comments from the last Friday postgame show was someone who lamented that Dave Kohler doesn't talk enough and he wants more. And he was wondering when I was going to do another solo show. Well, you got it this week. And you mentioned a show, you couldn't quite remember what it was, where I was on and for like an hour and said three things. Yeah, that was an old school episode with Cenk and Wes, and then Ben walked in the middle. Man, I was off to the side over there. I had nothing. I can't compete with those blabbermouths, but that's why Cenk and Ben at least are natural talk show hosts, and they're good at it, and they should continue doing it. But now you have plenty of Dave Kohler. Another comment asked me, what did I think about Cenk's comments about the French election? By the way, this is why this job is so easy, this whole media, you know, talk show host. Because first there's a French election and you can comment on it. And then you can comment on what Cenk said about it. And then next week someone can comment on what I said about what Cenk said. The material is easy to get to. Studying the meaning of the French election, or at least the first round, is a lot of research, hard work. You got to understand France. I don't. Commenting on what Cenk said about it is the easiest thing in the world. So I'll do that. For the most part, Cenk's comments were fine, but he kept saying over and over, and this is probably what the person was asking about. He kept saying, well, look, when you're given, the people don't want the establishment, but when you're giving a left-wing choice like Macron, people will vote left-wing. And he said this three or four times in his piece, but what is he talking about? What left-wing choice? Macron is not left-wing. In the papers, he's described as centrist, and it seems like a pretty good description in a lot of ways. Yes, he's more open to immigration, but he is in favor of dismantling the welfare state in France or reducing it, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's definitely not a left-wing thing. So yes, Cenk is right in analyzing that the people in France and many other countries want to overthrow the current system democratically, in democratic ways, of course. And that's obvious. That's why the two leading vote getters in France were from outside the mainstream parties. But it was not the choice between a right winger and a left winger. It was the choice between an unknown, seemingly smart, but unknown former banker guy versus a xenophobe nationalist who has taken over from her father, but trying to be a little softer. Speaking of the French election, just this week, so now it's in earnest. Now it's a two-person race, runoffs May 7th, I believe, Sunday, May 7th. There was a great incident in French city, Amiens. I'm not sure I can pronounce it right. But Macron was going to meet with some union representatives and others about from a factory in his home area, by the way, that where the workers are on strike. And he was going to meet offsite with these, the union representatives and some other higher placed people. Meanwhile, when Marine Le Pen got wind of that, she rushed over to the city and she met with the workers right out striking right outside the plant as if she's a woman of the people. And that's how she's positioning herself, although she's a hateful bigot and racist and probably anti-Semite. But she kind of out-Trumped in both senses of the word Macron on that incident. And this is where electoral politics and campaigns get real and they get dirty. And Macron says he doesn't want to do demagoguery. He doesn't want to take the easy wins, but be careful because Le Pen will take the easy wins. She got great optics, great press out of this meeting with the striking workers outside the factory. And a couple more of these, and before you know it, in a matter of 2 weeks, she could be leading. And that would be devastating. So I hope Macron plays a little more politics and tries to win this thing. But that's my take on Cenk's take, that if he really, really wants to always stick to that left-right narrative. So he put Macron in the left side of the equation there politically, and it didn't make any sense. Macron is not a left winger. To defend Cenk, he did at one point in his segment say, we don't really know how much of a left winger Macron is, but he continually repeated during his segment that he was the left wing choice. So that's my take on that. Someone made a very insightful, perceptive comment on Steve badmouthing his coworkers. Yes, you're right. He does that. He mentioned how when Jordan Chariton needs help, when he's having problems with his coworkers, he texts Steve. That would have been a fine comment if he had just said when Jordan Chariton needs help talking about some work issues, he texts me. But there was no need to add the little problems with other coworkers. So that commenter was on the ball. And that comment struck me while I was sitting here when Steve said it. He didn't have to add that extra little bit that Jordan's has some problems that I'm not even aware of with his coworkers. So I'm checking to see if that's all I have on comments, and I believe it is. But the comments are really blowing up in the post-game postings on the website. So if you're a member and you're listening to this and you like it or you don't like it or you want to add to it, join in. Malcolm and Steve are in there commenting and maybe I'll do the same. So we're 7 minutes in and I've done one of my 10 stories. So I don't know who took bets on over 20 minutes, but it's looking good for you. But let's see, because I don't have a lot to say. So I found a very amusing news story that I just want to bring up. That's what this Kohler Post Games show is about, little things. So the other day or yesterday or 2 days ago, a Russian naval intelligence ship collided with a merchant freighter in the Black Sea and sunk. Just sunk, poof, gone. All the sailors were rescued, which is good, thankfully. But so a Russian naval intelligence ship, Russia, the big bad country, one of their naval intelligence ships, collided with a merchant vessel. Guess what it was carrying? It was carrying 8,800 sheep. And it was coming from Jordan and going to Romania or something like that. So this mighty Russia, the second biggest power in the world, they have a naval ship that collided with a sheep transport ship and sunk. The sheep ship was barely injured at all or barely damaged at all. So this goes back to like the Cold War and that ridiculous battle that we had with the incompetent Soviet Union for decades. They stink at what they do. They have crappy technology and infrastructure. Their ships sink when they hit a bunch of sheep. So I find that ludicrous and funny about Russia. I looked into their naval ship now to defend them a little. It was built in 1970 in the Polish shipyards in Gdansk. Now, if you remember, that's where the Polish shipyard where Lech Walesa came out of and led the Solidarity movement to overthrow communism in Russia and start the end of the Soviet bloc. And in 1970, I believe Walesa was working at that shipyard. So maybe he sabotaged this ship way back in 1970. Maybe he put some faulty electricity on it or something so that way in the future in 2017, what is that, 47 years later, it would crash, it would sink when it collided with a ship carrying a bunch of sheep. But that's a little interesting long range footnote to that story. Another story, big announcement that British Petroleum, BP, found 200 million barrels of previously inaccessible oil in the Gulf of Mexico under a salt dome. So, sounds like a lot, 200 million barrels, they previously couldn't get to it. First, how did they get to it? It's interesting. Usually, it would take a year for petroleum engineers and geoscientists to... So this oil that they found is under a salt dome, which is an elevated, basically, layer of evaporites. It pushes the rock above it up, creates little holes, and the oil fills into those gaps. And it's usually very hard to find this oil. When they blew Spindletop in Texas in 18th or early 20th century or late 19th century, it was a salt dome that they tapped into. And for decades, the only technology was to look for the salt domes and drill holes into it and hope that you get oil out of it. Seismic tools came up later, but until BP just in the past, you know, year or so, still these seismic studies would take years to go through the data to try to determine if there was oil in these salt domes and whether it was worth drilling in. But this enterprising BP geoscientist or engineer or computer scientist borrowed the BP supercomputer, crunched the data, and in 2 weeks concluded that there is oil in this salt dome, which saves BP who knows how many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in drilling costs and speeds up the production process. Of course, we're not celebrating that they found more oil that they're going to drill, burn, and contribute to greenhouse gases or global warming or climate change, but they did. On the other hand, 200 million barrels sounds like a lot. It's not. The world consumes 100 million barrels of oil a day. So all this for 2 days worth of oil, that's the big announcement. They found 2 days worth of oil untapped and previously inaccessible in the Gulf of Mexico. Whoopee. Everyone's heard of Brexit, but now we got to talk about Vexit. What's Vexit? Venezuela leaving the Organization of American States. No, it doesn't matter one bit because the Organization of American States is irrelevant. And Venezuela was going to get kicked out of the Organization of American States. So rather than get kicked out, they just said, we're quitting. It's a 2-year process, which is kind of like Brexit. That's going to be about a 2-year process. And it's just another sign of Venezuela continuing to collapse. I will eagerly read the history book on what's going on in Venezuela in a couple of years. Is their trouble due completely to the incompetence of Chavez in his later years and Maduro, his successor? Or is this really instigated by US and corporate international global forces that want to get a piece of the Venezuelan pie and steal their oil and exploit their natural resources and their people and take control of the country, and they're afraid of the socialist experiment? I have a feeling in this case that it's more absolute incompetence and messing with the markets in a totally dangerous and damaging way from Maduro and Chavez in his later years. And of course, the collapse in the price of oil. So the whole house of cards in Venezuela collapsed. But I'm not naive. Global interests, corporate interests, US interests, CIA and all that did exactly the same thing in Chile, although that was 50 years ago with Allende. They could be doing it on a smaller scale here in Venezuela, or it could be a little bit of both, but I await the historians to give the final judgment on why Venezuela collapsed exactly. But it is definitely collapsing. The riots go on day after day. And now they're leaving the Organization of American States. As soon as things stabilize there, they'll just come right back. So it's not that big a deal. All right, now one of the main events in what I have for you. Well, it's my obituary segment. But before I do the obituary segment, Steve asked me in the last postgame show, Dave, so tell me, where do these obituaries come from? Why do you pick them? What does the New York Times do? How do they write the obituaries? Well, I didn't have any answers for them, but all those questions will now be answered by a new documentary that's coming out. It might already be released, It's called Obit. And it's a documentary that focuses on the New York Times obituary writing process. Bart?
Hey, Dave, I got more information on that. If anyone's interested, it's already out in movie theaters right now. It's starting to play in New York, and eventually it will be playing in other theaters. If anybody's interested in checking out, just go to orbitdoc.com.
Obit.
Obitdoc.com to look for the screenings for that documentary. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Well, maybe we should go.
I'm there, dude.
I'm definitely going to see it. Then we'll talk about it on here. I read the review of it. And yeah, the New York Times puts a lot of care into their obituaries, especially of the people they call the near great. So yeah, when President so-and-so or Leonid Brezhnev dies, of course they're going to have a good obituary of it. It's going to be on the front page. But when the person who gave the slinky, the name Slinky, dies, no one's going to cover it except this crack staff at the New York Times. They don't make obituaries like the graveyard of journalism. They don't give it to the young, inexperienced reporters and make them work their way up. They take it seriously. The one question I really want answered is if they really do prepare the obituaries ahead of time of older people. For example, Jimmy Carter. Is their obituary already written? George H.W. Bush. Is that obituary already written so that I can just go right out the moment those people die? I don't know the answer for sure, but I'd like to know. And there was one New York Times obituary editor in the mid-20th century in particular. I forget his name. I don't even know if he's alive or dead, ironically. But he is the one who gave such care to the obituary, and he launched the New York Times on that trajectory of putting a lot of effort into their obituaries. So all of you should check out that website, obitdoc, is that what it is? And try to find where you can screen that movie or get it from Netflix if it's there, and we'll talk about it in a future postgame. Now, this was a big week in obituaries. Joni died. But Joni doesn't quite qualify for what I'm talking about because everybody knows about Joni. You've probably already read about her. You have something on Joni?
Well, no. Honestly, Dave, I think a certain generation probably don't know who the actress Erin Moran is. So you may want to highlight more.
Well, I just told you Joni is the character from Happy Days and the actress is Erin Moran. The big thing about her life, but everyone's talking about it, it's all on the front pages. Her career went nowhere after the 17 episodes that she did of Joni Loves Chachi or Chachi Loves Joni, whichever way it went. And her life went into a bit of a tailspin. In 2008, which is decades later, she lost her home in the foreclosure crisis, moved to a trailer park in Indiana to be closer to her husband's parents. Her husband sounds like, I mean, the whole marriage between Joni and this husband sounds wonderful. They really seem to care about each other and love each other. And I believe she died in his arms in bed, which is very touching. She had cancer. She just, a melanoma, a severe one. She just found out about it about 6 months ago, and then it was too late. She was gone 6 months later. So that is a sad tale. From, yeah, anyone who grew up in the 70s, the characters of Happy Days were right there. I think we did an obit of Al, the diner owner, a couple of years ago. The actor was also named Al. I forget his name already.
Al Marino.
Al Marino. It might have been this exact, yeah. No. Okay, so another big death was the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Pirsig. I read that book in high school, and I loved it. But back in high school, I was a contemplative guy, philosophic. I thought that was cool. I thought it was bright, a broaden your view of the world. Later in life, I'm no longer that contemplative guy. It's more about going out and having fun. Yeah, you got to be nice to your fellow people and you got to understand the world and be well informed and be thoughtful. Yeah, you don't want to be a shallow moron. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance to a 16, 17-year-old today. You don't need that stuff. When you're older, you know, go get your boys or your girls and go have fun and be educated and smart and aware of the world. But you don't need to be contemplative to the degree of that book, even though I really liked it when I read it. I don't remember a damn thing about it. The other big bio is the film director Is his name Jonathan? I wasn't going to do it, though Bart convinced me. Jonathan Demme? Am I getting, is that his first name?
Unfortunately, we lost Jonathan Demme, who passed away from cancer in the throat. And I'm just like looking at, there's so many movies he has done, and I totally forgot. No, he's mostly well known for doing Philadelphia and Silence of the Lambs. But a lot of people don't know that he's also an excellent director at doing music documentaries and music performance movies. He also directed the Talking Heads movie, Stop Making Sense, which to me is up there as the gold standard of music documentaries, like The Last Waltz. And he also did Melvin and Howard, the story about how this guy driving down the road picked up this hitchhiker, and apparently this hitchhiker was Howard Hughes.
Okay.
Yeah, and he also did...
we don't need to go through his whole list, please.
Well, you know, people should know that he also did a documentary on Jimmy Carter, which is well worth looking into.
Well, people should find that, yeah.
Yeah, it's and also he did a documentary on Spalding Gray, swimming to Cambodia.
Right, I remember that. Yeah. Okay, so normally Jonathan Demme would be too big of a star for this segment. I cover, like the New York Times says, the near great, and he was a great guy. He was big. He's a front page obituary, not a back page obituary. But I want to talk to him because Bart reminded me that he did direct Stop Making Sense. That movie did have an impact on me. I went to college in New York in the fall of 1985, and I was a little innocent suburban kid. And in one of the first few days out there, a bunch of people who I met at school, we were uptown in New York City, and we all got in the subway and went downtown to the Village to watch Stop Making Sense on some small movie theater. I thought it was awesome. The whole experience was awesome. It was a big growing up moment for me to get out and about all by myself in New York City and watch this movie, this concert film. I had never watched a concert film in my life, but I liked the music's great. And the way it opens the layer after layer of the Talking Heads was awesome. And that really set a tone for me as I moved from the contemplative teenage guy to the guy who did stuff and didn't worry so much about the contemplation. So... yeah, I guess without realizing Jonathan Demme did have an impact on me in that sense. And by the way, the mid-80s was kind of like the end of the raw and real and genuine New York. The money started coming in big time in the late 80s, and a lot of the small movie theaters and the independent bookstores and all the unique culture of New York started to get wiped out and commercialized. It's not all gone, but it's a lot less than it was 25 years ago, 30 maybe now. So that's Jonathan Demme. He does make my obits. But the one I really want to cover is this guy from Chile, Augustine Edwards, who died. He is a guy who I bet nobody's ever heard of, but he died, and I want to talk about him. He comes from a wealthy Chilean family. His last name is Edwards because his family origins are from England, and he was a big newspaper. He took over from his dad. And he took over a newspaper and other media properties in Chile. And he was conservative. And he was instrumental in running propaganda against Salvador Allende in the late 60s, early 70s. He was even funded by the CIA to propagate that propaganda in his newspapers. And he worked really hard to make sure Allende wasn't elected in the first place. And he failed at that, but he kept going afterwards with CIA help and all of his big corporate backings to sow discord in Chile and to create problems for Salvador Allende. And despite all this, and it was known that he was doing it with his paper, Allende did not shut him down. And eventually, you know what happened? Their long-term CIA-backed coup succeeded and Pinochet overthrew Allende. Salvador Allende committed suicide. Pinochet took over, and soon thereafter, he shut down newspapers that opposed him because Allende was not a dictator, but of course Pinochet was. Augustine Edwards, what did he do? He left Chile, fucking asshole. You caused all the problems. Then you went to live in the U.S. comfortably and peacefully for a few years until things calmed down, and then you went back to Chile. And then when you got cancer, you came to the U.S. to get treatment. It didn't work out for you, and you died. Just like Joni, you died of cancer. But Joni brought cheer and joy to millions of Americans for 10 years. You brought nothing but pain to the Chilean people for 30 years. So with Pinochet gone and a bunch of generals who have recently died, and now this guy, all the big shots from that Chilean coup are dying off. Not enough of them went to jail. I don't know of any. But that's Agustin Edwards, major player in the 1973 overthrow of Allende and the aftermath and the precursor to that. So he's gone. And that's my real obituary of the week. So I've been on for 25 minutes and I'm not even done. So all right, now confess up. Who thought I couldn't make 20 minutes?
We have Irma and Gigi with their hands up.
All right. And does that mean anyone thought I could make it?
I don't know.
Oh,
I was on the fence, dude.
Well, you're always on the fence, Bart. But we got Tim Frisch, Jacory, Edwin on my side. You were totally right. In fact, I may get kicked out of here by Edwin if I don't hurry up with this stuff.
Take your time.
It's all you, Dave.
Interesting story from Idaho. So the state legislature, sure, in the closing days of this recent session, before taking off for the year, they finish their year of work in April, and then that's it. And then they take a leave until the next year. Not a bad gig. But in the closing days of session, they passed a bill to repeal sales tax on groceries. There are only, I believe, 7 states in the United States that put a sales tax on groceries. 2 of them are Mississippi and Alabama. And as one of the legislators in Idaho said, you do not want to be on any list that Mississippi and Alabama are on unless it's college football. So Idaho, the legislature, which is dominated by Republicans, of course, they repealed the sales tax on groceries, which I believe I support because I don't like any sales taxes. They're regressive. It's especially bad on groceries, which people need to live. This is a tax that they cut. So you'd think the governor would sign this, the Republican governor. But no, he vetoed the bill passed by the state legislature. And since they're out of session, that's it. They can't override the veto. Now, there's two elements to talk about in here. One is the substance, the sales tax on groceries. But I already mentioned that. I don't like it. I'm glad they repealed it. I'm glad that 43 out of the 50 U.S. states do not have a sales tax on groceries. I would have liked Idaho to join them. And the Republicans, I thought they loved removing taxes. The legislator did, but the governor didn't. Now, but what did he say? Why? He said, because if we remove that tax, the state won't have enough money to do all the things that we need to do. And they're having a lot of problems with flooding and road damage in Idaho. And he said, we need that money. More rain is coming. And we can't cut state revenues now. He wants to remove dramatic ups and downs in the state revenue stream so that government avoids disruptive and dysfunctional shortfalls and funding holdbacks needed to balance the budget. Yeah, then you're right. So why do Republicans at all levels always want to cut taxes? It's a terrible idea because you need taxes to even out the dramatic ups and downs in state revenue streams. So the governor is saying the right things, except the way to get that, I don't think, is by a sales tax on groceries. It's by the right level of taxation on income. Dylan Radigan disagrees with that. Maybe we could talk about that in the future. So I think the Republican Party is full of contradictions, not just at the federal level, but at the state level. And the Idaho legislature did the right thing. The governor vetoed it. Vetoed it. The veto can't be overridden because they're out of session. And now the state legislators are suing the governor because they said he did not issue his veto within the required 10 days after passing the bill. He did it on day 11. However, the law says the governor has 10 days after receiving the bill. And he did issue his veto on the 10th day after receiving the bill. So now there's a huge political court case in Idaho about whether this veto by the governor is legal or not. I'm almost certain that it's going to be upheld in the courts for the reason I just gave. The whole reason for that law is because they don't want the legislature to pass a bill and then hold on to it secretly for 10 days and then release it and said, oh, sorry, governor, you don't have a chance to veto it. No, they have to deliver it to the governor, and then his 10-day clock goes on. The governor says, well, there's a very easy way for you to override my veto. Don't take a vacation for the rest of the year starting on April 29th or whatever day, April 27th. He's kind of right. And don't wait till the last minute to pass bills. Pass them at least on the 11th day from the end so that you can override vetoes. There was one bill, I forgot what it was, in Idaho that passed unanimously in both chambers of the Idaho legislature. Unanimously. The governor vetoed it. They couldn't override his veto because they're out of session. Friggin' idiots. The politicians are so stupid. Well, it's all a big game, but I would have liked to see Idaho join the ranks of the 43 smarter states that don't have sales tax on grocery. All right. Pope Francis is doing great things for the poor. He opened a laundromat for homeless people in Rome, and there are six machines in it and an ironing area so that the homeless people can now wash their clothes and iron them. It's part of his year of mercy, his jubilee or year of mercy. I think it's part of that. I think the jubilee year of mercy might have ended already. I don't know. I'm here to make fun of that story, but I don't really want to. Yeah, it's good that the Pope, setting an example, opening a laundromat with six machines for the homeless population of Rome. However, if the Catholic Church really means it, they should have done this 40, 50 years, whenever the laundromat was invented, maybe 70 years ago. Why do you wait to 2017 to open one laundromat with six machines for all the homeless people in Rome? Good, a little too late, but it's the right step and it's symbolic, and I think it's funny. I think it's funny. A big victory for public health in Mexico, going back to Latin America. Mexico has been deemed or ratified as the third country in the world and the first in Latin America to eliminate the disease trachoma. Trachoma is a bacterial disease that infects the eyes and can cause blindness, especially in young children. And it's horrible, and Mexico has eliminated it. It's now, of course, it doesn't exist in other countries. Like in Canada, there are no diseases at all because it's too damn cold. But among the countries where trachoma existed, Mexico became the third in the world and the first in the Americas to eliminate it. And that's a great thing. With all the problems Mexico has, and boy, do they have problems, I'm glad they were able to continue this public health initiative and successfully eliminate another disease from another country in the world. This is when we talk about, despite all the bad news, there's progress in the world. This is the type of thing that we're talking about. And I think we're staying in Latin America for my final story. Ecuador has a cash transfer program to the indigent. It started off 15 years ago with about $15 per month. It has now grown to $50 per month. To qualify, you have to make sure families have to prove that their kids are still going to school and are still attending, visiting health clinics for basic medical needs. If you do that, you get the direct cash transfer. $50 a month now in Ecuador for an indigent family is quite nice. And the UN did a study, the cynics would say, well, what's the point? You give them cash, they spend it. It doesn't help them. You're not doing anything long run. Wrong. The UN did an extensive study and research on this, and it's showing very good results. It is pulling people and families, individuals and families, out of poverty, and not just in the short run, but in the long run. Of course, it isn't that long of a run. They only started the program about 15 years ago, but it seems to be working, and that's great news. I'm not saying direct cash transfers would work in every country, especially in a big industrial country. But we do talk on the postgame show. Malcolm advocates for this all the time. A minimum basic guaranteed income from the government. They're trying it in one of the Scandinavian countries. It's kind of a similar concept. Look, give people money to satisfy their basic needs and then let them improve their life from there. Get an education, learn a vocation, get a job, start a business. It benefits everybody, the families and the country as a whole, because it pulls people out of poverty. And it's a great little program in Ecuador. I'm glad that the UN has confirmed that it's working. Ecuador just had a presidential election, and a left-leaning candidate whose first name is Lenin won. So that's good news. He's the only head of state in the entire world who is bound to a wheelchair. He was mugged many years ago in a parking lot. Even though he gave the muggers all of his cash and his wallet and everything he had, they shot him in the back anyway, which is sick. Took him 4 years to recover. Recover means that he wasn't living in agonizing pain anymore, but he's still confined to a wheelchair. He can't walk. But now he's the president of Ecuador, and I hope he continues to do good things in that country, not follow the Maduro model, but maybe more the Evo Morales, or just the model of his predecessor, Rafael Correa. And no, I'm not done. This reminds me that in Argentina, there's an election coming up, and all of a sudden, the sort of centrist or right-wing candidate, Mauricio Macri, he's not up for election. It's just a legislative election, but he's now spending a lot of money on public works in Argentina, all over the place. Suddenly, everywhere in the past couple of months, people are saying there's public works projects everywhere. He's buying votes, of course, in the election, but it's a good thing. Public works projects are smart. They help in the short run to stimulate the economy, and Argentina needs it. And they help in the long run because they build an infrastructure, which you can build a long run economic platform and base in Argentina. So perhaps it's better than just the subsidies that his predecessors or that Hugo Chavez would dole out to their people. Perhaps this is better. So I've been saying on the postgame show for months now, we are waiting to see after a couple of years how this president of Argentina does. And I don't know nearly enough to have a conclusion on it yet. Maybe we get an interview going on that. But this program, he seems to be responding to the needs of the people. An election's coming up, and that's what elections in a democracy are for, so that the candidates can be held to account for what the people want. The people want spending, they want infrastructure, they want jobs, they want to stimulate their country and their economy, and he's doing it. So that's good, as long as he's not doing it in a corrupt fashion. 128, 37 minutes, maybe a world record for David, certainly a record in the number of words that I've spoken in 30 minutes. People should be happy about that. I'm looking forward to the comments. But thanks for being TYT members and supporting this. I hope that this helps you enjoy your membership a little more. Next time, I hope to have some booze maybe. Then I can go another 15, 20 minutes.